Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and by the way, it's not often two public radio hosts get the chance to sit down for a relaxed, wide-ranging conversation, but that's what I'll be doing with Tavis Smiley to mark his 20th year in broadcasting. We'll talk about politics, including the 2012 election, as well as race, the media, turning failure into success, and whatever is the hot topic of the day. Join us Wednesday, April 27th at the Cooper Union. Tickets on the events page at WNYC.org. Now, a few minutes with Elaine Scarry, professor of aesthetics at Harvard. She was named one of Prospect Magazine's top 100 public intellectuals, and her writing has covered everything from representations of beauty, the importance of pain, the rule of law, and the politics of air travel. Her new book is called Thinking in an Emergency. And the book starts very small but ends very big in profiling the way in which individual citizens behave during an emergency. Scarry tries to argue that thinking and stress are not inherently incompatible. Yet over much of the last 50 years, Scarry argues that governments have tried to convince us that the only way to act in a state of emergency is through centralized power. The notion of emergency has been used as an excuse to spy on citizens, engage in torture, and go to war without congressional approval. If we can remember as individuals to think during times of emergency, she says, then perhaps we can hold our government accountable to act more compassionately at the same time. Elaine Scarry, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
We'll discuss your four models of emergency thinking. We'll go through them one by one. But first, I know that a lot of the initial inspiration for this book came from your work after 9/11, and you've written several essays pointing out that on that day, the only real successful example of emergency thinking was on United 93, the plane that was brought down by passengers over Pennsylvania, not the government. Do you want to discuss what September 11th teaches us about emergency thinking?
Well, I think you gave a good summary of it. The passengers on Flight 93 acted in 23 minutes, and by acted I mean they gathered information from people they were speaking with who were on the ground. They consulted each other and verified the information, sometimes asking their own telephone contacts if what they had heard from a fellow passenger was true, namely that the World Trade Towers had been struck. They deliberated, they voted, they actually took a vote, they acted to bring down the plane. The plane, in contrast, that hit the Pentagon had about at least 55 minutes of warning when it was highly probable that that was a plane under control of the terrorists, and about, I'd say, 35 minutes when it was certain, because a passenger, Barbara Olson, had even called her husband, Ted Olson, in the government. And yet the Pentagon was not able to protect the Pentagon, let alone the rest of the country. And this is not to fault the Pentagon, but it is to say that certainly a major question that is raised by that outcome is whether citizens should be ceding all their own sense of responsibility to centralized powers, because it is citizens acting together that often are most effective. For many years, the arguments about why we needed a centralized military power, moral arguments about why it should be distributed to the citizenry, were often trumped by the statement that, well, that might have been true in a slower era, but now we live in a fast world, so there's no time for citizen consultation. But on 9/11 and in many other circumstances, it's exactly citizens who can act and should not only think of themselves as having responsibility, but recognize that we actually do have the ability to do that.
You say that thinking and stress and speed aren't inherently incompatible, but doesn't the history of social psychology say sort of the opposite? There's the whole notion of groupthink, where making important decisions as a cohesive unit actually leads to less original thinking because no one wants to be the person to propose an original idea that might be rejected by the peers and things like that.
Well, you know, sometimes we have deliberative assemblies, let's say Congress in eras when it's actually working, that are specifically designed to make sure that you have competitive voices And, you know, and let's say in Congress in years where there's been a declaration of war, and we had declarations of war in 1812, 1846, 1898, World War I, and World War II. And if you actually look at the deliberations, the level of debate was very high. And in part it was high because people actually tested the arguments for going to war against their own best arguments that would urge us not to go to war. But even there were other factors that also encouraged people to debate. Namely, they may just want to cut a good figure and show they can make a good speech and compete with their fellow congressmen. Those are not bad motives. They encourage people to try and come up with the best arguments on opposite sides. When you have closed deliberative councils, as we often have now in the executive branch of government, there really is an inhibition on anyone bringing up counter evidence or counter arguments because there's such a clear hierarchy with the president at the center. And there are many occasions where you do want exactly that kind of chamber of very knowledgeable people to be talking with one person at the center. But going to war when what's at stake is injuring a foreign population and almost certainly bringing great injury to your own fellow citizens, then you want a kind of forum that is going to encourage the best kind of testing of arguments. And, you know, I would just say generally that while it may seem that in many cases where speed is required, we don't see careful deliberation, what the book tries to show is that we can set up procedures in advance. We can set up protocols and procedures and laws in advance that anticipate what will happen and therefore provide the best kind of remedies for the emergency in advance, and thereby leaving some mental room left over in one's head to still be able to think clearly.
Elaine Scarry, author of Thinking in an Emergency, with us on WNYC. And okay, let's go briefly through your four models of emergency thinking, very specific examples of individuals acting effectively in an emergency. And after you describe them, I'll ask you to draw the line to the bigger picture of how governments and the body politic should act. So you start with CPR. Then you go to mutual aid agreements, where communities band together to develop a plan for emergencies. Swiss fallout shelters. Swiss law requires that every house build and maintain a fallout shelter. And then finally to the national level, the way in which you see the U.S. government exploiting emergency to circumvent the Constitution. Why'd you include CPR?
CPR is an example of the way in which a single person is at risk and a single person can act to help the person. And whereas the other models begin to move to larger groups of neighborhoods and towns and then finally to the nation state. But on the level of individuals, I wanted to use CPR to help make recognizable the fact that when something is a habit or a protocol or a learned procedure, that does not mean that there's not thinking taking place. It's just that the thinking has taken place in advance of the accident. So CPR involves what might be described as a rigid set of procedures and counting rules that you should administer so many beats to the heart and then so many breaths to the lungs in some cases, or now they say in other cases, if you're not trained, you should just work on the heart. But that can seem like a set of rules, and people say, where is the thinking? The thinking is there because a huge amount of research went in over many centuries, I might add, went into coming up with the knowledge that we actually had the power to bring somebody who was dead or nearly dead back to life. That is, someone whose heart and lungs had undergone an arrest.
So what's the model? Convince me that CPR, an individual act, has a lesson to offer for governments and collective action.
Well, first of all, I started by saying it was an individual act. It is also a collective act because CPR only works if it's widely distributed. Since most heart attacks, three-fourths of all heart attacks happen outside a hospital, saving the person is going to depend on the knowledge of CPR being very widely distributed. So just for example, in places where there's uneven training, the percent of a survival rate for out-of-hospital heart attacks is roughly 1% in New York, 1% in Los Angeles, 1% in Chicago, and in Sweden it's 5% because the streets are a little easier to move in. But the real counterexample is Japan, where in Osaka they underwent a huge training of 1.4 million people a year, and they raised the overall survival rate to 12%, which is, obviously much better than in these other places. And I should say that there are regions in the United States where, because of wide community training, the survival rate is much higher than the 1% figure.
We're going to run out of time in a couple of minutes, but very briefly, Swiss fallout shelters, where the law requires that every house build and maintain a fallout shelter. What was compelling about that to you?
Well, because in our own country, the United States, at a certain point, people seem to have decided, without ever talking about it, that we didn't need to have fallout shelters, and they would simply increase the chance that we would go to war. That did not, however, stop us from accruing larger and larger nuclear arsenals, so that we now have, out of 22,000 nuclear weapons worldwide, the United States and Russia together own 21,000 of them.
The neighborhood fallout shelter if it exists.
Pardon me?
And we would have to find the neighborhood fallout shelter if it exists.
Exactly, if it exists. Whereas in Switzerland, they have fallout shelters for 114% of their population, and that's come about through a procedure of laws that require people to each have a fallout shelter. It's come about through massive building of hospitals inside mountains. It's come about through the building of many shelters, 290 shelters for cultural objects that are precious to the Swiss people, following the Geneva and Hague rules about cultural property. And so the Swiss medical research asserts that, of course, if there's a direct hit with a nuclear weapon, one would not survive. But if it falls even 2 kilometers away, the fallout shelter will give its citizenry or its residents 500 times the level of protection. By the way, I'm not arguing that we should keep nuclear weapons and have fallout shelters. I'm arguing we should get rid of nuclear weapons. But the fact of at least having an ethic of what the Swiss call equality of survival, making sure that your full population is protected equally. That's essential to democracy.
Sure.
Whereas in our own country, we've spent the same amount of money just for a presidential fallout shelter, but not for the citizenry.
So before you go, and it kind of follows up on that point, Steve from the Bronx on our comments page challenges you with this example. Please ask Ms. Gary how her notions of the efficacy of citizens acting spontaneously during crises bears on her opinion about whether or not these citizens should have the prerogative to be armed with handguns and rifles. It seems to me that she's making a good case for the cause of the NRA.
Well, your blogger is very insightful. And let me just correct 2 things. First of all, when I say spontaneous action by citizens, remember that I talk about deliberating and training in advance and coming up with procedures. But yes, your listener is exactly right. I am somebody who believes very much in the right to bear arms, that you must distribute to the whole country an obligation for overseeing how we use the country's arsenal. That doesn't mean I think we should distribute guns, and I am actually not. I'm not a friend of the National Rifle Association, and I don't believe that the right to bear arms is primarily designed or designed at all to foster gun clubs or to allow criminals to carry guns. But I certainly think that the authority for determining whether the country goes to war against a foreign population belongs to the citizenry as a whole. And by the way, that is a view not only held by militarists, but Gandhi is someone who said at one point, of all the evil committed by the British against India, the worst is the disarming of the population. Give us back our arms, and then we'll tell you whether we want to use them. I don't want to use arms. I'm somebody who's against war, but I believe that a crucial break on war is having deliberative participation by the citizenry as well as the congressional legislature.
Quite a thing for history's most famous pacifist to have said.
Yes.
Thinking in an Emergency is the title of the new book by Harvard professor Elaine Scarry. Thank you so much for a very thought-provoking conversation.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, we began this week on Monday with a call-in on conversations that mattered in your synagogue, church, mosque, or Hindu temple over the last weekend. So let's end like this. After the break, we will cite chapter and verse from an ambitious new attempt to write a Bible for humanists. Stay with us.